forward to these two sections. We're going to try to keep most people around here. Yes. And they're an awesome church. Jay and Kenny have been very supportive of what we're trying to do in the state. Intermixed between some of y'all in the back, you'll see some guys wearing polos. If you have a question in the next couple of hours, please find one of those guys and they'll find me, and we'll figure out a solution if you have any issues. We actually have a long distance award, I think. We have a couple over here from Chattanooga. Hey, Mr. Robert. So you want to go over there and say hi to him. I think he wins the long distance award today. So I'll give you a watch or something, so after it's over. But it's my honor and privilege to bring Dr. Gary Habermas. He is a professor at Liberty University, considered one of the foremost experts on the resurrection and other things. An interesting note is he used to be a hockey coach at Liberty, and he told me today he's not a coach anymore, but you're always a coach. So you can either call him Dr. Gary or Coach after it's over if you want to talk with him. And one of the things, after each session, we're going to have about an hour session, and then we'll have a 15-minute break. Please go back. We have Doug Powell, who is a author of this book called Resurrection Eyewitness. It's a really neat book that they have they're going to have at Lifeway, and it covers almost everything that Dr. Habermas is going to cover. We also have Dr. Habermas's books in the back as well, and we have other things for you to read. Birmingham Theological Seminary has brought us some stuff for you to look through as well. We have the Reasonable Faith group of Montgomery here as well. They're a group, if after this is over, an apologetic seems like something you want to really dig deep into. Their guys will be back there too. They meet once a week here at Fraser. So I'm sure they would like for y'all to come and talk to them as well. But I'm going to get out of the way. But here's Dr. Habermas.
This is a lot of folks for Saturday morning. Yes, I was a hockey coach for a while. 9 years as head coach. And I tell people, hockey's a Christian sport, just so you know. Pastors used to introduce me, and they don't introduce me anymore. No, they used to introduce me, and I'd have to figure out some kind of comeback, because in those days they'd say, well, oh, by the way, he's a hockey coach. You might want to ask him how that's Christian, and then he'd go sit down. And so I had to come up with something. So what I started saying was, you know, hockey's a Christian sport because hockey players and Baptists solve their problems in the same manner. I'm Baptist, so I added that. Now I feel like I'm looking out at you guys, but you're all kind of blurry. I've been on the road for a week and a half. I frequently quote the prominent philosopher Red Skelton, who said, "Late to bed and early to rise makes me sleepier than most other guys," and that's me for the last few nights. So anyway, glad to be with you. Let me tell you about my three topics this morning, and we'll get started. Matt picked the topics out, so if you don't like them, you can go talk to him. Or we can do something else with you during the break. You know, we can take a break. Resurrection is not one of my three topics this morning. That, like, never happens. Well, the second one, minimal facts, is getting kind of close, but I'll tell you that in a second. All right, my first lecture this morning, and there are sheets back there, right? I'm glad you guys reminded me they're back there. The first one is near-death experiences. That one's kind of written out. We use that one on college campuses, and that's the form they wanted in. The other ones are more like outlines. But the first topic this morning, I'll tell you why I do near-death experiences. You might think of that as kind of being a religious topic, but not being a Christian topic. More about that. The second topic is minimal facts argument. It's more like a method, but I'll use the resurrection as my example. So we'll be doing resurrection as the chief instance of minimal facts. It's a way to argue for the resurrection that that allows you to get critics talking to you on their nickel, so to speak, on their own grounds. Because a lot of times people will say, now the resurrection can't have happened because all you have, the only source you have is a Christian book, and a Christian book's prejudiced because you all are Christians. You know, so, and that's the main decision we, I mean, the main thing we go after, and we, the argument is that we can show the resurrection happen from the skeptic's viewpoint. That's secondly today. And then thirdly, a very common issue in the church, namely, what do we do about emotional doubt? What do we do about people who have questions? Almost all Christians at some time have questions about their faith. Matter of fact, I had breakfast this morning with two folks that are here, and they got interested in apologetics because of their own questions. That's very, very typical. So the question for the third lecture is, what do we do with, or how do we handle our own questions? Okay? And depending on the time, I'll try to keep kind of close watch on the time, and if I'm just getting killed on the time and I'm not able to finish my lecture, I might have to go right through it, but I'll try to leave some room for some questions. We'll just see how that goes. All right, my first topic this morning is near-death experiences. Let me tell you why I even do this topic. A lot of people see it as kind of a, like I said, a religious topic, but not a Christian topic. They'll say, well, you know, it's religious for the people who are not religious. It's a good argument, but it's not really a Christian argument, and it really isn't. Because I don't think near-death experiences tell us which religion is correct. It just tells us a certain things that are incorrect. For example, last weekend I had a debate at New Orleans Baptist Seminary. For someone who hates debate as much as I do, I sure end up in a lot of them. And so it's a major, probably best-known debate series in this country. It happens every year at New Orleans Baptist Seminary. And we bring, this time, six speakers in. And I was the main debater with a former evangelical who's now an atheist. And Michael Shermer, nice guy. And then he had two guys who, he named two fellows who had his back, so to speak, and I named two guys. Mine were... if you read Christian Apologetics, I think you'll know these names, J.P. Moreland and Peter Kraft, or sometimes Peter Kraft called, but he pronounces it Peter Kraft. And they were the guys on my side. And we had a two-day debate, and it was on the subject, is there an afterlife? And I had three arguments for an afterlife. And my three arguments, well, the very first argument on the list was near-death experiences. And I tried to tell them, see, that's the kind of situation where it would work, because we were debating with atheists, and whereas near-death experiences don't really tell you which worldview is correct, they tell you that something religious is going on. So if you're an atheist, you're kind of out in the cold on these arguments. And there's so much evidence for near-death experiences that it's a really good icebreaker for Christian apologetics. Now, by icebreaker, I mean this. A lot of times when you're doing resurrection, if you're talking about the resurrection, people will say, well, yeah, I mean, you know, you've got some things that you might call evidence, but how do we know the resurrection happened? I mean, it's a miracle, and miracles don't happen, right? So I don't really care how much evidence you have. I just know it's not a miracle. That's how people argue with you a lot. And so what near-death experiences do is they're icebreakers in the sense that you could say, well, according to surveys, the vast majority of Americans believe in an afterlife. Even the vast majority of Americans with graduate degrees, according to one poll, they believe in an afterlife. And there's probably some reasons for that. And one of those reasons is near-death experiences. And if there's already an afterlife, this is how you get into it, if there already is an afterlife, then why are you objecting to be talking about a resurrection? Because a resurrection is in that same genre, right? It's the same category of afterlife. It would be like, How about this for an analogy? It would be like intelligent design. Intelligent design doesn't say Christianity is true. It just says atheism and a few other options are false. And that's the value of near-death experiences. It's an icebreaker like intelligent design is an icebreaker. Intelligent design doesn't tell you Jesus died for our sins. It just says God did something, and so therefore views that don't believe in God are false. All right, so this morning I'm going to talk about evidential near-death cases. When you read the news, the most common things you learn about near-death experiences is that someone says they died or they came close to it. That's why they're called near-death experiences. And let's say it happens in this room, because I'll use this example again. So let's say while I'm lecturing, somebody passes out and all of a sudden the lecture stops and we have to call 911 and they're working on somebody and they get you, you know, set again and you're conscious. They get you straightened out. They're getting ready to take you to the hospital to make sure you're okay. And you say, well, I don't know what you all were so worried about me for. I was doing fine. Actually, I felt pretty good. You know, what do you mean you felt pretty good? Well, I was like, my vantage point was up above you by 15, 20 feet, and I didn't even know that guy was me down there. Because, you know, I couldn't see my face. People were all gathered around me. And secondly, we always identify our position from where our consciousness is, right? I don't have to look in a mirror to say, oh yeah, that's me, I must be standing right here. I just think, this is me with all my memories, so I'm here. And so if I'm looking down, I'm thinking, that's not me, this is me. This is where all my memories are. And these folks are not in a, you know, they're not in a situation anymore where they're in pain. And they're almost always immediately convinced that there's an afterlife. Almost always they say, wow, this is cool. This is just what I've always believed. I if I stay here very long, I'm going to be kind of going up to heaven. And sometimes they do start going up. And that's what the press talks about. The press talks about being above your body, kind of taking off and going down a tunnel and seeing a light and being very, very peaceful and not fearing death and seeing loved ones who are deceased. That's a fairly common picture. But if I were just to tell you that, well, first of all, in this postmodern age, some people might think, that's cool. And for this generation, that's sometimes thought to be evidence, just that you're telling a story. I don't think like that. I think there's got to be a lot better evidence than that. But some people will say, well, I did this last night. I was speaking with a group last night, and the people there said, well, we've got one of those in our family. And someone else said, yeah, we've got one of those in our family, too. They're very, very common. But just because you have one in your family or you know somebody who has one doesn't mean it's true, right? It could be a hallucination or something. So what I'm interested in are things that happen during near-death states that are evidential. I look for evidential cases. And I've been doing this. My first love and research is the resurrection of Jesus. Near-death experiences are the next topic after the resurrection that I've spent the most time on. And so I've been doing this for, well over 30 years. And I've got 100-plus evidential cases where people report things they wouldn't otherwise know unless they really were located somewhere else, like outside their body. So I'm going to give you some examples. Now, before we begin, let me give you some definitions of death. In order to talk about near death, I suppose we should talk about, you know, for a moment here, how close people are to death. I'll give you four successive definitions that get more and more serious as we move up. The first one is what we're talking about, near death. Near death is a state from which you can reasonably be expected to die if you don't get intervening medical help. Your heart stops beating. would probably be the most common one. Somehow your heart stops beating and you get help and you're okay. But that's near death. Okay. Next state up is no heartbeat. And it would be most ideal to measure that with an EKG. A flat EKG reading would show that there's no immediate, no obvious heart activity. Then the next most evidential one, and sometimes the definition that most people use, is a flat EEG. But medical doctors, by and large, don't hook up EEGs. I mean, they do sometimes, but that's flat brain, and that's more evidential. And then the last category is not you in your near-death state, but what if you believe you've seen somebody in your family who's been dead for 5 years? You're not irreversibly dead. You're near death, but they're irreversibly dead. Does that make sense? They're biologically dead. Often the definition of biological death, you can tell the non-Christian bias here, the non-religious bias. Often the last stage, biological death, is defined as a state from which you cannot return. So if you do return, you weren't. So they just put it right in the definition. If you do return, you were near death. If you don't return, then you're biologically dead. But what about the person, let's say a deceased grandparent that you see while you're going down the tunnel and so on? What do you do with those cases? Well, what if he gives you some evidence that you were really talking to him? All right, so those are some of the categories. Now, one I'm gonna tell you right away, this is one of the most interesting developments in recent science. And that is, if you have a cardiac arrest, not necessarily common heart data, heart phenomena, but if you have cardiac arrest, you will be brain dead in a maximum of 20 seconds. See, they used to say, in the old days, they used to say about evidence, they'd say, well, if you have no heart activity, that's significant. But man, if we had a case with no brain activity, that would be really significant. That's how they used to talk about this 20 years ago. But now they know if you have no heart activity, you'll have no brain activity very, very quickly. It's 11 to 20 seconds. You have no brain activity. So that's pretty quick. So somebody who has a cardiac arrest, and let's say they're quote unquote out for 5 minutes. That's a very evidential state because they're flat brain, flat heart. Neither the heart nor the brain's working. So from a natural viewpoint, your brain could be working somehow, but the tape recorder's not going. So if you're watching yourself, first of all, you wouldn't be seeing yourself because your brain wouldn't be working. But you wouldn't remember it later even if you did because there's no tape recorder going on. Your brain's not functioning. So that's why it's an evidential state. If you can see something, let's say while people are working on you, it takes 45 minutes to get you stabilized. Let's say you go, well, I kind of drifted out the side of the building out here. And did y'all hear those sirens out there? And you go, yeah, we thought they were for you. No, there was a car accident out here. It was really something. This red car went right through a stop sign, and guy was talking on the cell phone, went right through a stop sign and hit this blue car. Now, you can get a police report, and you can find out that happened right outside the church here. But let's say you passed out at 10 o'clock, and you're stabilized at 10:45. Let's say the car accident happens at 10:20. How did you know that if the tape recorder's not working? That's an example of an evidential case. Now, I'm just making that one up. Actually, some of these are much more evidential. So what I'm going to do is give you some examples, and I'm going to give you a mixture of evidential cases because some people are more interested in certain kinds of evidence than other kinds of evidence. For example, one skeptic, Susan Blackmore, she's a British psychologist. She's an, I believe she's an atheist. She said, before I'm going to believe near-death experiences are evidence for an afterlife, I need to see two kinds of cases, she said. I want cases where the person who saw the events that were confirmed, I want to see cases where those persons were blind. And secondly, I want them to report things that happened a ways away from here. Like it'd be really cool if it was 300 yards or a quarter mile, something like that. And then they couldn't just be, they wouldn't see it normally. Well, soon after she made that requirement, a study came out with near-death experiences in the blind. And there were 19 persons, most all of them were blind from birth. And this is really interesting because the only time they've ever seen something was during their near-death experience. And then after the near-death experience was over, they couldn't see anymore. But they reported things that could be verified. Like one fella, a bus went by, and he was able to, it was more like a trolley, and he was able to describe what this looked like, but he'd never seen a trolley before. Other people described where their family was located. Like if I'm in a hospital room and I visit, it's very common to visit the visitor's room where people are waiting for you during surgery. Where NDE folks are often drawn to where their family members are. And I'll hold that for a little while because from this, we get a category that I call near-death humor. There really are some humorous cases. They report some things that you go, oh no, sounds like a comedy thing. But I'll save that for just a few minutes. And it often comes from they're going to where their relatives are. So sometimes there's NDEs in the blind. That's an example for sure. NDEs in the blind. All right, the other thing she required was NDEs at a distance, away from the person. Because if it's in the room, if they hear one of you say something like, I'm going home, I guess this lecture's over. And let's say they know you. When the person comes to, they might say, Bob, did you say, I'm going home, there's a ball game on, and this lecture's obviously over? As a matter of fact, I did say that. Well, how did I know that, you know? If my brain wasn't working. So that's some mild evidence. But somebody could say, well, when you die in stages. You don't die like the old black and white Westerns. You don't die like this. You know, we hit the gold in the... That's not how death happens. And somebody says, well, oftentimes the last sense to go is hearing. So somebody could say, well, he heard you say that, but he wasn't totally dead. So that's why they want things a distance away. Now, here's an actual case. An agnostic pediatrician. Now, he had a double specialty. He was a pediatric brain specialist. He happened to be working the emergency room this night, and a little girl was brought in. She was 7 years old, and she had drowned in a pool. And a medical doctor was there at the side of the pool, and they know that she did not have a pulse for 19 minutes. She didn't have a pulse for 19 minutes. So they took her to the emergency room, and she had no gag reflex. Her pupils were fixed and dilated. These are signs usually that the brain's not working. And as soon as she got there, they had to hook her up to a breathing machine. And then they got her into ICU, and her folks went home for the night. But she was just hooked up to these machines. They gave her a 1 in 1,000 chance of living, a 1 in 10,000 chance of living with brain function. Folks went home. They didn't do anything extraordinary for her. And 3 days later, she revived spontaneously. I mean spontaneously because they didn't do any extra things. And she came to. And she looked up and she saw the one doctor, Melvin Morse, the one I told you about, the pediatrician. He had a beard. And she said, "Oh, you're the doctor with the beard. Thanks for saving my life." And he thought, how does she know that? And she goes, "Where's the tall, skinny doctor without the beard?" Well, his name was Bill Longhurst. And he said, I'll go get him for you," wondering, this is crazy. How does she know this stuff when her brain's not working? So he goes down the hall, gets the other doctor. They come and sit there with her. And it took her almost an hour to tell her story of what she remembered during the last 3 days. She could describe everything in the emergency room, where the furniture was, where the crash cart was, where the different machines were, who did what, and so on. You're saying, well, that's kind of a long shot, but maybe she knew, maybe she somehow could hear things, maybe she got word of where this is. But then she said an angel came for her. Angel's name is Elizabeth. Well, we don't have any tests for angels. That's an interesting story, but we can't plug Elizabeth into a machine. But the girl said, "Elizabeth allowed me to look in on my family, to see where my family was. Elizabeth allowed me to look in on my family." And they said, "Oh, really? Here's a contact point with the real world. I looked in on my family." Well, she couldn't see her family, right? Because she's hooked up in ICU to all these machines. And she said, "Yeah." She said, "My brother went upstairs to his bedroom, and he was playing with this G.I. Joe." And she said, "My sister," and she described what her sister is doing. One of them had turned on the radio, and she talked about this popular song that came on the radio. Her dad went in. He sat down in a chair. He was trying to read the paper or whatever, but he couldn't concentrate, so he put it down. And then she said, "My mom was making dinner in the kitchen." And again, the medical doctor was thinking, this is a contact point with the real world. She said, "Okay, what did your mom make for dinner?" This is 3 days later. It's two nights. "What did your mom make for dinner?" "Roast chicken and rice." Okay, roast chicken and rice. Well, of course, when they heard that the little girl had come to, the family's rushing in, and everybody gets there, and they see that the little girl's conscious, and she's doing fine. And the doctors say to the little boy, "What were you doing two nights ago? Do you remember where you were when you got back from the hospital?" To the little girl, to the sister, "What were you doing?" "Sir, where were you?" And to the wife, "What'd you make for dinner two nights ago?" "Oh, it wasn't much. I just threw together some chicken and rice." But she was comatose, and her brain wasn't working, and she could report what was going on in her home. Now, I've talked to this doctor. I try to call these folks and try to get information on what's going on, and I've talked to him for hours. He's no longer an agnostic. Now, isn't that interesting? Because she didn't say, "I saw God," or she didn't say, "I know Christianity's true." She just said, "I could see what my parents were doing." And people assumed that that was an afterlife, and therefore atheism is wrong. Just much like you say with intelligent design. Intelligent design doesn't prove Christianity's true, but it proves atheistic evolution is mistaken. All right, it's one of those topics. Like I said, it's an icebreaker. It gets you into apologetics. All right, so there's a case. I've got some other cases there in your sheet. There's a couple of tennis shoe cases. One is the famous Seattle case of one Maria, who who just came to Seattle that day, never been in Seattle before, got to Seattle to see her family, and she had this massive heart attack. They rushed her to the hospital in an ambulance, and besides being able to describe what happens in the emergency room, she said, "I was starting to go up above my body, and I started going through the floors. I started going through the floors in the hospital." And she said, "You guys know that over on that side of the hospital over there, on the roof, there is a large male tennis shoe." And I said, "What do you mean, large?" She goes, "It's large. It's really, really big." And she said, "It's the old blue canvas kind of shoe." She said, the little toe is worn almost all the way through. And the laces are underneath the shoe. The shoe's sitting on the laces. It's on top of the hospital." Well, she hadn't been there before. It's a very famous hospital. It's one of the best-known heart treatment centers in the U.S. And so a social worker was there, and she spoke Spanish, so she interpreted when this woman gave her account. And during her breaks, she went up to the ceiling, up to the roof, and she kind of looked out the windows. "Oh, nothing here, no tennis shoe here, no tennis shoe here." And she took kind of, because the lady told her where on what floor it was. And she'd almost checked everything she could, and she had a few more places to check. And when she looked out the window, kind of around the corner, this blue tennis shoe was there. And so she reached out and got it. You couldn't see it from the window. I mean, you had to kind of like, move out. And she got the shoe, and she came back and she put it behind her back. And she went into Maria's room, and she said, "Tell me one more time what that shoe looked like." And Maria said, "Oh, it's really big." Well, the shoe turned out to be a size 14, I think it was 14. Blue canvas. Little toe worn, and the laces weren't tied under the shoe, but the shoe was sitting on top of the laces. And she said, that looked like it. And she had retrieved this shoe. Now that's Seattle. There's another tennis shoe case in Hartford, Connecticut, where a lady, it's not like a copycat. This was way back in 1985, so more than 25 years ago. And this lady was in a hospital, was in trouble, with her vital signs. And she, too, said she went through the floors. And when she got on top of the hospital, she could see the Hartford, Connecticut skyline. And she looked down, and she saw a red tennis shoe. I don't know what it is about tennis shoes that end up on roofs, but she told this resident physician, and he kind of made fun of her. But then he got thinking about it, and he went and got this janitor. And they went up together, and the guy let him out, let the medical doctor out on the top floor. And they found this red tennis shoe, just like the gal described it. So there are cases like that. I just had this debate last week, I told you, and I spent a lot of time talking about near-death experiences, so I was summarizing some of the information. And I have a case where a woman was without heartbeat, which means she did not have brain waves, for 39 minutes. Another case, 40 minutes. Another case, a boy with 20 minutes. And more than 20 seconds without heartbeat, you're flat brain, flat heart. And it's an evidential state, from which to report things. And these people could report the data, all the way through it. Now, I gave you those definitions of death. These experiences happen after each of those definitions. What I mean is someone who's near death and they think they're losing them, and that's when they have this. In other words, it seems to be connected with death. It's that connection of I'm dying and now I'm kind of, moving out there. And like I said, I gave you some examples of cardiac arrest, so it's beyond flat heart. When the heart doesn't work, it's flat brain. And you have some cases where the person is with a loved one who had died a little earlier. Now, you have another case in your notes, which kind of a sad story of a family, a mother and two sons, who were involved in a fiery car wreck. And the boys didn't know this, but the mother died at the scene of the accident. And they took the ambulances took the boys to two different hospitals, and they were both burned very badly. The older one's name is Peter. I don't know what the younger one is named. And a medical doctor who does a lot of research with death and dying came in and sat with the little boy, the youngest one. And he was in a coma. All three were burnt. And the mother died, and she sat with the little boy, and he kind of came to for a few moments, what she calls a clear moment. And she looked at him, and he was very badly burnt, and he looked up at her and smiled, which is kind of odd. And she said, "How are you feeling?" And he said, "I'm doing well. Mom and Peter said that I can come with them." And then he lapsed back into the coma, and he died a few minutes later. And as she got up and walked past the nurse's station, the nurses stopped her and said, "We just got a call from the other hospital. Peter died 10 minutes ago." Now, Mom had been dead for, you could check into this. I know the medical doctor. The mother now had perhaps been dead for a couple hours. And Peter had died 10 minutes before that. How did the boy know that the mother was dead and that his brother had died in another hospital? But he was happy, and he said, "They said I can come with them." And he died. Now, in this case, it's not just a sad story. We're not asking about the case of the little boy. We're asking, how did he know the other people have been dead for a while? That's that biological death category. You won't come back from it. Now, let me just pause there for a moment. I have some other evidential cases I can give you, but I told you I would stop and talk a little bit about near-death humor. I mean, if it wasn't so serious, this would just be really cute, but it's evidential. These are evidential cases. In one case, a woman was being operated on. She was dying of cancer, and they were doing some surgery to kind of prolong her life a little bit, and she died on the operating table. And they worked on her for 45 minutes, and they couldn't get her heart beating. So she said, later, she said she was up above her body, and she gave, which this is very common, but she gave an account of who was wearing what, jewelry that people had on, what people said in the room, and so on. But they were working on her, and as far as they knew, she was dead. Well, they worked on her long enough, and they covered her with a sheet, and they left her for the fellas to come take her body to the hospital morgue. And the fellas came in and took her body and was wheeling her down the hall, and she sat up. Sort of Twilight Zone-y, I guess. But she sat up, and they were kind of like, "Whoa." And they ran and got the doctor, and they gave her a shot of adrenaline, and she came to. In another case, they pronounced a man dead, and also covered his head with a sheet, and the fellows were coming to take him to the hospital morgue. But a scrub nurse came in, and she was cleaning the room up. And while she was doing that, a male doctor came in. And as the person said later, they were doing things in the hospital room that they shouldn't have been doing. But the patient said, "I was up above my body and I watched everything." And she reported him. How's that? Be careful if there's someone who's dying around you. And then probably my favorite, there was a lady who was in surgery, and she also reached a crisis point. And I told you that sometimes people are drawn to their family members. And during surgery, she said she was up above her body, and then she looked in a couple floors away and to a waiting room where her family members were located. And her brother-in-law was pacing in the room like this, and she looked up and saw him. And he was pacing, and she said, he said, he goes, he stops, looks at his watch, and he says, if she's going to kick the bucket, I hope she hurry up and does it. I have an appointment. And when she came to, she said, did you say this? And he just kind of looked kind of sheepishly, but he did say that. And she gave evidence. Now, one of the most interesting cases that combines evidence with humor is a case of an Atlanta lady. She's actually a fairly well-known country singer. And she had a brain aneurysm. And they had to take care of this before it ruptured. So they took her to a clinic in Phoenix to be checked out. And I don't know if this is still the case, but at the time, there was only one doctor in the country that did this kind of surgery. It's a very delicate surgery. And what they do is they open your skull and they go in and they see where the aneurysm is exactly. And if it's up on top, they can kind of fix it more easily. But if it's deep in your brain, you're not going to survive if they open that up. So what they do is they start this procedure called standstill. And they basically kill their patient. They have to do it and have to take a chance on this person staying alive. So they cooled her body temperature down to 60 degrees, drained her blood out of her head. Now, I don't mean by opening it up. I mean by making the blood go down in the body and out of the head. They shocked her heart until the blood stopped beating. And, of course, the brain was able to become non-existent very quickly. And while he was working on her, he was sitting at the top of the skull, and she said she was immediately out of the body. And she said she watched the surgery from a position that she said it was as if she were sitting in his lap or looking over his shoulder. That was the point. And she said to him, said, what kind of a bone saw would you use? Said, that thing looked crazy. And he said, draw it. Well, would you be able to draw a bone saw? What would it look like? Say, I don't know, like a pizza cutter maybe. With a big thing on it. I don't know. But he drew it. It looked like a pen. A pen with a little tiny opening here and a little tiny blade. So she drew it. And then she said, you had like a Ludwig looking set next to you. And he said, draw. Well, she said, it's a box that opened, and there was a little tiny saw thing that, whatever you call it. Well, that's what it was. They were adjustable saw heads that you pop into this, a very expensive machine, what's called a Midas Rex bone saw. And so she described this deal with the interchanging heads. She heard conversations in the room. There were 30 medical personnel that went in and out of the room. And there was a cardiologist who couldn't find one of her blood vessels. And so they had to go to the other side to get a better vessel, you know, from which to enter. And she heard him say that. And they in her report that they had trouble with this blood vessel. She heard him say that. But one of this is, you know, several years ago, before the clinically correct thing became really tight. But one of the male doctors in the room said something that was very politically incorrect, made a comment about it. And when she came to, she was telling all these details, what the saw looked like, the saw. She had six different kinds of cooperation that she could report. And one of them was she heard the doctor tell the joke. And when he came in to check on her, a cardiologist, when he came in to check on her, she said, "Did you say this about me?" And she paid me the joke. She said she liked the guy. I guess that was to his benefit, you know, if we did the food or something. But she repeated this joke. And the guy said, "You need to get some sleep." And he turned around and walked out of the room. Well, I'm one of the people that I've done a lot of research into death experiences. So they asked me to write a blurb for the back of the book. They sent me a loose leaf version of the book from which I could do a recommendation. And when the book came out, they took the joke out of it because they thought it was politically incorrect. But like I tell people, I have the loose leaf version, so I've got the joke in my version. But what's interesting about that, it's not like, aha, I have a joke. It was evidential because she could report what the guy said. She could report the content, even though she was in a very dire strait. By the way, they fixed the aneurysm. It was successful, and she's doing fine. But it was a very delicate surgery where you're kind of on the edge of dying. That's why it's called near death. Now, I'm watching here. We've got a few minutes left. I can keep going, but this might be a topic where some of you want to shot at something. If not, I'll go to another area. Some of you, I'm guessing. How many of you, while I was talking, you had questions in your mind about all of these things consistent with Christianity? Like, you could say, didn't I read a case about a person who was an atheist? And they had this really good near-death experience where they experienced peace and joy and so on. Any of you did you think of things while I was talking about Christianity? Several of you. These are real common questions. And I'll address that kind of question because I might get several of you at once. I'll address that briefly here. But any other questions before I go on? Yes. "90 Minutes in Heaven" and "23 Minutes in Hell." You like titles like that? Both bestsellers, from what I understand. Certainly the 90 Minutes in Heaven. I've not read the 23 Minutes in Hell because somebody told me that book is, there's almost nothing about the experience, and the rest of it's the person just telling you what they think about hell. Well, I don't want to read a book like that. So, I mean, I don't care what they think hell is. You know, a lot of people tell you what they think. But the 90 Minutes in Heaven book I did read, actually the guy never really makes it into heaven, right? If you read the story, he kind of goes through the gates. He's just going through the gates and he's hearing this gorgeous music and hearing these gorgeous colors, seeing these gorgeous colors, and it ends. He gets thrown back in his body. He was pronounced dead at the, it was a really bad car accident in Texas. I can tell you, I've interviewed a lot of near-death people. It reads like an authentic near-death case. So I wouldn't really question it at all. There's no evidence. There's no, cases I'm interested in, since I teach apologetics, since I teach evidences, I'm interested in the cases where there's evidence that the person was somewhere else. It was a good read, but it wasn't evidence. I've read two books recently from hospice workers, where people have some really neat experiences like, you know, can you hear that music? Or D.L. Moody, I'm told, I've not looked it up, but I'm told that D.L. Moody in his biography, he had an experience like this on his deathbed. And they had lost two grandchildren. And again, I haven't looked it up, but he was reported to have said, he said, heaven's opened up. I can see it. This is incredible. And there's Jimmy and Johnny, or whatever their names were. Here's these boys. And he was so glad to see the grandchildren. And he said, if this is death, it's easy. And that's the last thing he said. So there's a lot of those cases. And when you, I'm curious. You don't have to, nobody has to give any details. I'm not trying to embarrass anybody. But how many of you have one of these sorts of stories? It's in your family or a close friend. You know somebody who's, okay, a lot of hands up. They're fairly common. We have like three in our family. And you wonder, when you think about it, it's a situation that we call, C.S. Lewis called the chronological snobbery, that just because somebody lived a long time ago, we think they're stupid, right? Oh, they're in the Middle Ages. You didn't expect them to teach you anything, do you? Well, maybe this is where people get the idea that there's an afterlife and there's all these stories because they would have witnessed this. We probably hear a lot more because of modern technology, you know, bringing people back. But there's always these accounts. Oxford University Press published a book years ago of medieval near-death experiences from that time. Now, your other part of your question, what about the hell cases? Hell cases are a minority of cases, but there's a fair number of them. And some of them aren't very nice. I mean, I know a couple of cases of atheists who said they were, there are atheists who say that they had a good experience. But I mean, one of the accounts is, this is the name of it, I was an atheist until I died. That was one of the titles. I know several atheists who had near-death experiences. And some atheists said they were in hell. I know a couple cases where people said they became Christians during the near-death experience in hell. You say, well, that's not fair. That sounds like a second chance. You've got to remember, this is a near-death experience, so they're not finally dead. They're not irreversibly dead. Some people have serious car accidents or have serious sicknesses. They get closer to death than we do. But there are some cases. In fact, I told the group last night, I know one in Chattanooga where this fella had consecutive heart failures having a stress test. And every time he came to, he said, Doctor, I'm in hell. What should I do? And they said his hair was standing straight up. Doctor, I'm in hell. The doctor was an agnostic. And he was bothered that the guy was asking him what he could do to get out of hell. And he's doing CPR on the guy. So the guy comes to just long enough to talk, and he goes out again. And somebody came to me and said, Doctor, I'm in hell. What should I do? I don't know, I'm not a pastor, and he keeps working on the guy. The guy comes to him then, and what should I do? In hell? And he goes, there's no pastor. And he keeps working on the guy. Well, three days later, I believe it was, he went to the hospital room with his clipboard. He said, you said you were in hell the other day. The guy said, what? He said, you said you were in hell. Goes, not that I know. And the guy said, there were nurses all around. He said, look, I'm not saying, I'm saying I have no memory. And this doctor hypothesized that if you have an experience like that, you may block it out of your mind and not remember. About 1/3 to 2/3 of people near death have near-death experiences. So it's fairly common. It's not real rare. Anybody else before I address the question about how come these guys don't always have things that look like they're consistent with Christianity? Heaven is for real. That's the best one. Now there's another one out, which I haven't read. The Boy Who Visited Heaven, or whatever, something just like that. They're both Christian books. I read that. You do wonder about, we all know 4-year-olds who report, can talk to
but really the well, this is fairly common. The little boy says, "Why don't you tell me I had a sister? Why don't you tell me I had no?" And they said, "Well, you do have a sister. You know your sister. That's not who I mean." And the miscarriage. And he said, "Well, I mean, you don't have any reason to tell your children miscarried 7 years ago. You know, I mean, tell me, you may not tell them." But the little boy didn't know. And they said, "Well, how old is she?" Well, she's like 11. Whatever it was, she was older. She wasn't. And so he said, he told her things about this little girl. And, you know, it's hard to know those things. He said, so there's marks in there. There's indications that something, you know, going on. That's a real report. I don't know if I can say that everything the four-year-old said was accurate. Pardon? That's correct. His great-grandfather, who... That's correct. That's correct. He'd never seen the great-grandfather picture, but they went and got a picture. You know, one thing I know is that one of those cases where the guy said he went to hell, the guy was a Christian. That's the only case like that I know. In fact, he was a deacon in the Baptist church. Not to make you wonder a little bit about deacons in Baptist churches. Just kidding. So maybe you'll join the other church in town. Like I said, I'm a Baptist minister, so. Things don't always... Now, I will say this. In that particular case, the guy had another heart attack, another death experience, at the end of life, he went to heaven. So whatever it is, I guess he made some decisions. I was speaking in Chattanooga one time. In fact, it's probably still there. I haven't moved to this Bible. The Bible that's your favorite one, it's just like all totally beat up. You know, here it is right here. This woman, her husband came up to me and said, ever read the book about the guy that had all the heart attacks and he went to hell but he was a Christian? Yeah. That's a cousin. Here's his name and number, if you want to call him. I said, what's your problem? Oh, he'll be glad to talk to you. He's a nice guy. So she wrote it down here. Just for me. I've never called the fellow. Hey, dude, I haven't been to hell. You know, I'm not exactly a good icebreaker. But like I said, the guy had another account later and said he went to heaven. Okay, what do we do about cases where people report things that we wonder if... let's just use that for an example. What about a guy who says he's a Christian and he has a health experience? Well, you might go, you know, that's not too hard to answer. We're not always who we claim to be, right? And I don't know what this guy called him. But what about an atheist who says, oh, great, I'll never fear death again. It's super. Or what about a Jewish believer who says, a Christian says, I saw Jesus. And the Jewish believer says, I saw an angel. Well, that's not a contradiction. A Christian could see an angel too. But what about a Hindu? A number of these, there's one thing you've heard of these cases with Hindus. And they say Shiva came and took me away. Okay. So what do you do with this? And here's a general answer I would give you. When I notice the way I constructed the evidence today. I think it's an icebreaker in the sense that it's evidence for an afterlife. People who don't believe in an afterlife are the hardest, they're the hardest to answer this material. But what kind of an afterlife reports? I was an atheist and I felt great. I saw a Hindu God. Notice I didn't use any of those cases because none of those cases, we go, well, yeah, you didn't, because they're not Christian. Well, I didn't use people who saw Jesus in those moments either. Because see, those aren't the evidential cases. There's no evidence for those. So if you're a Hindu, I wouldn't be surprised if you think it's a Hindu heaven. And the knife cuts both ways. If you're a Christian, I would think you would think it was a Christian heaven. But that doesn't mean exactly what you saw. There's no evidence. You know what I mean? You can't tell whose heaven you were in. There's no evidence for whose heaven you're in. Well, I thought you said you saw Shiva. Well, he thought it was a supernatural person. He gave the identification. I don't know. I don't know if somebody saw Jesus. I don't know that. So I'm just saying, we all interpret experiences from our viewpoint, but they're not proportions for which there's any evidence. So I only report the car accidents outside the door, the tennis shoe on top of the hospital, the little girl who knew what mom was making for dinner. That's the kind of things I report. I can't tell you. She said, remember I already told you she saw an angel named Elizabeth, and I said there's no test for Elizabeth. I can't tell if she was with an angel or not. I'm open, but I don't know if she was with an angel. I just don't want to talk about things for which I don't have evidence, because my criteria are, I can only talk about the evidential cases. So, is this a good time to, I'm 5 minutes early, so this is a good time to stop? Okay. Do you want to make an announcement, or should I just tell them to? Minute break. Bathrooms, obviously, I'm sure, out there, and snacks outside, coffee and so on. So see you in about 15 minutes. Talk about the minimal facts, but to give us a little bit of introduction. For those of you who go to this church or who are coming back to this church, I do lecture on the resurrection tomorrow. So that's a little bit of an introduction to resurrection.